what is a somatically enlightened person like? What do they embody? Here's part two of my conversation with Kelly, episode number 7 in this series about somatic philosophy, whatever that might be. All episodes are available from philoprax.se, that's philoprax.se. Look for articles and podcasts in the menu tab. And my name is Miriam van der Valk. Yes, finding a good therapist and also a good mindfulness teacher. That's what I think I was going with it. Because I once signed up to do a mindfulness course, and it turned out to be the worst stupid nonsense that I have ever.
Oh no!
Yes, after the first class, I wrote a long email to this woman and I said, "Can I have my money back? This is not for me. Can we please do? I don't know. I mean, we just got to this. First of all, it was set in this public preschool, which we have in Sweden. I don't know what the concept would be.
Okay, yeah.
In the kitchen there, but it smelt of poo. Because it's a bathing place. Yeah. And she had put up these little silly notes that she obviously got from some like calendar that she like cut to pieces from a mindfulness calendar that you put on the wall. It was obvious that there were like little cards with, you know, mindfulness sentences on them. Like, remember to whatever.
And, oh my gosh.
And she said, pick one of them. And I came after the best good ones were taken. So I had to take one that I didn't believe in or that didn't represent me. And and she goes, let's now eat these apples that everybody had already eaten, you know. So, you've already eaten them. So did you remember, how did they taste? What was the sensation on your lips and teeth when you ate them? And was like, oh my God, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, it was just a dreadful experience. But I didn't get my money back. I just didn't go anymore.
No. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
But that's also important. Finding like a mindfulness teacher who knows what they're doing.
Yes, there are so many people now doing mindfulness, and you know, I've been to sessions where there are beginners there and they're just trying mindfulness for the first time, and they're, by the end of the day, they are so thrilled with the mindfulness experience and what it's done for them and how wonderful it is, and they're going to go and teach it. And they've just been to one sort of, you know, introductory, and they're going to go and teach it. And and there are, you know, certificate programs now where you can go and get a certificate in mindfulness and, you know, go and teach it. But, you know, if it's not grounded in, you know, and that's where I, you know, doing Zen practice for many years, they're very strict about, you know, my teacher would never have allowed me to begin teaching without, you know, he said, you have to do hundreds of hours of your own meditation practice first before you can go out and begin teaching other people. Because it's not a cognitive thing. You know, it's not just, I'm going to take this course and I'm going to understand it and I'm going to, you know, maybe meditate to this app every now and then and then go and teach it to other people. I mean, you can teach people some basics for sure, but, you know, to really, teach people, mindfulness and the breadth and the depth of what it can do. It's more than just, you know, reading a book or taking a few classes with somebody.
Yeah. It is. And teaching isn't the same as, you know, summarizing an article or a book. You know, this is what I read. That's not teaching. Oh, it's not the teaching that I'm interested in for this podcast series, for sure. It's more like In Swedish, you would say handledning, which means leading by the hand. And that's the word we use for mentoring.
Yeah.
Or like guidance. So that's that's the kind of teaching. So I've been thinking about what would you do if you were to have a class of somatic philosophy? What would the course material be like? And what would the classroom look like? Mm-hmm. So very funny thoughts to explore a little bit. So some things can be written down. Which things? Yes. And what can we talk about? And how can we phrase them? And in which order should we put them? You know, it's interesting stuff. And then there is a point where the words are not enough. And you have to, like you said, the presence and the holding the space. And and that is the kind of instructor, guide, teacher, mentoring that,
Do they embody what they're teaching?
Yeah, embodiment. There we go again. Do they embody what they're teaching? Yes. That's like the, that's the first telltale sign.
Yes. And it's tough when, you know, if you're a beginner, with anything, you don't know what you don't know. And so if somebody seems to know what they're talking about and they, you know, seem to have levels of certification, it can sound like, okay, this is a, this must be a legitimate, teacher. I know for me, after I have been doing mindfulness for a while, when I can walk into a person's space and I can tell if they're an embodied person. And people who have been doing mindfulness practice for many, many years, there is, and I would imagine this is what it would be like to be in the presence of somebody like the Dalai Lama. You just, there is just something different about the space that, and the, their presence.
Yes.
You know, there is an embodiment there that's really hard to describe, but there's like a spaciousness. It's very open. It's very safe. And you can feel it as soon as you're around this person. And it's very different from being around somebody who, you know, has a really big ego.
Yes. Or someone that who's very angry. Someone who's very hurt.
Yes.
Or bitter.
Yes.
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 Yeah. Let's try. You said very spacious, open, and safe. This is like the how being next to this person feels. Let's try to say more about this because I think it's a good cue for how to be able to talk about and teach somatic philosophy, you know, in 10 years or something, when we have established what somatic philosophy is, which we don't really know yet. But
still working on it.
Yeah, absolutely. But so like trying to look at what a kind of somatically enlightened person is like. Try to see how that person is. So I think this, when you say spaciousness, it's, I love that idea. It's spaciousness, but it's also spaciousness and presence because it's not air, you know, it's, you can feel that
it's palpable.
Yeah. And human, or is it human? Yeah. Is that what I mean? A human, it's like alive and, but it's also alive and personalized, like it's something that you can meet, like a face, something you can be eye to, you can be face to face. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's so hard because it's a felt experience. It's so hard to put language around
it. I know.
But yes, it's like this, there's a natural connection, I guess. That's, you know, where the face... being able to
Maybe not even if you're, it doesn't have to be face. I mean, they can look at the other way, but you can still know that there is a possibility for this person to see me and I can see them. So like the I in me can meet the I. Oh, I actually mean the I as in the organ with the lid on. I didn't mean this.
E-Y-E-I.
Yes, yes. So the I in me can see the I in you.
Yes.
Yeah, like a very profound humanness, maybe.
Yes. And it's different from, I mean, there's some people that have a charisma about them that is nice to be around.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily have the same openness and spaciousness that somebody who has this, has a deepened somatic intelligence, you know?
Precisely. It's not just the same feeling that when you were next to the nicest person at the party.
Yes.
You know, who makes you feel good and makes you laugh.
Who tells the jokes.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Yes.
And who is generous with
everything. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But you can have that trait anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's actually a scale that somebody devised quite a few years ago. And I think openness was one of the key measures on it that would show how successful you would be. It was like tied to success or something. And openness, I think it was openness that was the one of the key measures that they found. And I don't know why this just popped into my head, but I'm thinking, I would love to go back to that now to see how they described openness in this context, because there's the very cognitive kind of side of being open and friendly and approachable, but then there's this openness, this somatic openness, which is very, very different.
Yeah. Wait, I'm by the computer. I'm just, since we are not in a hurry, so I'm just going to see what comes up. If I am, openness to experience is an article on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Is one of the domains which are used to describe human personality in the five-factor model. Is that five-factor model? Is that
No, it wasn't the five-factor model, because I'm familiar with that one and that openness to experience. And this one, this is going back quite a few years. That's why I'm having a hard time pulling it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to do with a prediction of success.
Openness to experience. It's still openness to experience as a predictor and outcome of upward job, career mobility, career success, leadership. And no, it's definitely the five factor model of things.
This one was more, it was more like a relational thing, not the openness to experience in that model.
Mm.
I think it was probably, I remember hearing it from a speaker, and it was this man's model that he had created, and he wrote a book about it, and it probably never went very far. That's why we can't find anything on it now.
But as you remember it, since we weren't able to quote this person anyway, so as you remember it, it's not the openness to experience.
It's not the openness to experience. It's more the openness in a friendly kind of relational way to, like, how approachable are you as a person, right? And so this was supposed to be, and I suppose it would fit into openness to experience in a way, but this man was using it in a different way.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was just making me think about, you know, these kind of leadership models and this openness and friendliness and relational. It's like a relational kind of intelligence, right?
Mm.
Like a social intelligence. And that doesn't always incorporate somatic intelligence.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because so much of the world operates on non-somatic intelligence. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to recognize it when you're not aware of it,
mm-hmm.
you know? Or yeah, or to recognize that, yeah, that somebody doesn't have it. Mm-hmm. And it's taken me a long time to have that awareness,
mm.
because I was always, you know, I was the thinker.
Yeah.
And, you know, if somebody seemed approachable and, friendly, mm. You know, and that they weren't going to be threatening in any way, then it's sort of like, okay, this is somebody that I can trust.
Yeah.
And, but now for me, like and that's not that I expect everybody to have this, level of intelligence, but I just appreciate it. You know, when I'm in the presence of somebody who has this somatic intelligence, it's mm-hmm. sort of like, oh my gosh, I really appreciate this. And it's just like a different way of connecting with people.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's a much deeper way of connecting with people.
Yes, much deeper and more like, if I understand what you mean, but like a timeless way of connecting. That's not, I keep thinking that the vision I have in my head is the opposite. You know, when you have met someone and you talk to them and then you go home and then some weeks pass and you're like, oh, I should know and I should text this person. Are they going to wonder why I'm not texting? Oh God. And then you text and you're like, I'm sorry, I haven't been in touch. I mean, I've stopped doing that now because I don't have time. If I'm only going to live for 1,000 years, I don't have time to apologize for being late with answering text messages. This deeper connection doesn't care about how quickly you responded or whether you used the polite way to say thank you for the last time I met you, and you know, like we say in Sweden all the time, and you know, it doesn't matter because it's really the heart to heart, for lack of better words.
Yes. And there's a wisdom about it too,
mm-hmm.
right? That it's not just because there's so much of the heart to heart stuff that people talk about now. And it's almost like in a spiritual bypassing kind of way,
mm-hmm.
you know, where it doesn't have the wisdom component to it. And I think, you know, we have to be careful when we start talking about, like even just somatic intelligence, or start looking at things in a siloed kind of way, we lose the connection with the whole bigger picture.
Mm.
That we have to keep, you know, we have logic for a reason, for a very good reason. And we can't just be these somatic beings, you know, going out and, you know, not caring about anything, and we're just gonna love one another and you know, just be with one another. We have to use our wisdom, we have to use our logic, we have to have the balance and the, you know, the wholeness of all of these things too. And I think that's really important too, because you know, we've so many times throughout history have, you know, one thing has become like the new area of exploration, and everybody goes down that rabbit hole and forgets about everything else, you know. And we have to keep wisdom as part of it, so that it's, you know, not just this isolated, you know, we're all going to be in our bodies and have these heart to heart connections, you know.
Hopefully this will be one of, that should definitely be on the list of the things that somatic philosophy, for whatever that may turn out to be, that should fix that, you know, to not fix, but overbridge to bring together these.
Yes.
These different. And I think it's one of the things that always in my life, these paradoxes come up. Such as, like individualism, the two
the two individualisms, the one that it's definitely not and the one that it definitely is, and the being separate as something that is a necessary, that is necessary for being able to unite, and and this playfulness in how reality or how language relates to reality. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
And then we have and things like we say that free will and determinism can't both be true at the same time, but I'm pretty sure they are. That's exactly the case. It's both.
Yes.
So and that's another way that language relates to reality. That's very funny, and it will be so interesting to see what this Semitic philosophy turns out to, like, you know, when, in a year when I can look back on the whole series and, you know, however many episodes it will be, I'm not even sure, might be 300 and maybe I'll never stop, but to be able to reflect and see what was learned and how can we where is the edge of language and you know, how do we transmit and how do we communicate in other ways, blah 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 blah, or you see, it's hard to talk about simply.
It is, I know, it's so hard. That's something I've struggled with so much over the years, and even in teaching mindfulness, you know, trying to put language around it, and mm-hmm. that's been a whole task in and of itself, is, you know, trying to put some language around the felt experience and around the experience of mindfulness practice, because it's beyond language.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's beyond language.
But for some people, it won't be enough to just say, oh, you have to experience it. I can't talk about it. So we have to say something. Yeah. We have
exactly.
to say,
That's a big challenge.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it just sounds like, okay, yeah, that sounds like a lot of hoochie-boochie. Yeah. You just have to experience it.
The embodied mindfulness class that you do?
Yes.
Embodied mindfulness. It sounds just like this unspeakable thing of of letting the consciousness sip through your cells.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's kind of the, not that there's ever really a goal in mindfulness practice, but that's kind of part of what you're working towards, is having that experience. And for so many people, you know, if you think of that as, maybe step 8 or 9, most people are at 1, you know? And so there's all of, because of all of these knots that we've had and all of these difficult experiences that we've had through our lives, we've got to work through a lot of that first. And in order to get to that place 8, you know, on the experience scale. It's just, you know, taking small steps at a time. And you know, some people come into these classes or courses and they've been doing it for a while, and maybe they're at a 4 or a 5, and they just feel kind of stuck. And, you know, so they're able to take tools and practices that will help them move beyond that. And for other people who are at, you know, points, the very beginning at the starting point, it's like, okay, here are some things that you can begin with. And then all of these other tools are there for you. So when you feel like you're ready to start exploring and experimenting with those, they're there for you. But you know, where do we begin with trying to reconnect we say mind and body, but for me, the mind incorporates the body, but we still understand that better, this mind body disconnect that we have, that we were talking about earlier.
Mm.
You know, how do we begin starting to restore that connection?
We have to say mind body disconnect. We don't have to say, but it's an easy image that we.
Yes.
But it's also funny that you say the mind incorporates the body, because to incorporate is to have a body that you fill something with. So it's like the mind has a body and in it is the body.
Yeah.
But that's perfect way of saying it.
Well, so Dan Siegel, who, he's a professor of clinical psychiatry at UCLA, and he's done all this pioneering work on the mind, and he's got a MindSight Institute. He's written many, many books all around what is mind and mindfulness and these kinds of things. And his definition of mind, he says that human mind is a relational and embodied process that regulates the flow of energy and information.
Oh, embodied process. Yeah. Oh,
a relational and embodied process that regulates the flow of energy and information. So when you think of mind that way, you know, it kind of, you can see how, you know, the body is part of that, because that's the information. So much information is coming in from, you know, there's the internal information that's coming through parts of the body, the external information that's coming through all the different, you know, doors of sensation. And that's all part of the process of mind.
Mm. So the word person, what is a person? Just in one sentence, please.
Yeah. What is a person? Oh my gosh.
Mind, or like, where do we fit these important things? Like, a person is has a name, like Miriam, right?
Yes.
And the mind fits somewhere there, and then my psychology fits somewhere, like my and my narrative fits in my psychology. Maybe could you say that? You think my narrative fits in my psychology? Oh yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I think that's a fair statement for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, because my narrative is in language, and language is shared among mm-hmm. other people, so it's like all there already there. We see the relationality, and also psychology is very clearly has to do with other people, because it's hard to imagine someone growing up without any other people. You know, that we know for a fact that they wouldn't last a day, but you know. Let's say someone was raised by machines. Would you even say that they had a psychology? Would they be, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's another thought experiment. But so we have person and psychology and narrative, and then we have the mind. Where in this, like, where are the borders?
Yeah, I know. And I feel like person in a lot of ways is like a language thing that we've done to categorize, okay, this
entity
here
that
looks like this and behaves like this is what you would call a person relative to a dog or a tree. Right.
A character in a book, like a character in a book isn't a person, it's someone who is alive.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it almost, in a lot of ways, feels like, it's like, I don't know, I guess it's very dependent on the individual and how their mind processes this notion of person, right? Because for me, person almost feels like, I don't know. It's really got me thinking now. How do I think about person?
Yeah, I think I'm quite pleased with what we said, and then the idea that it's not a made up. You can't have a made up person. It's a character.
That's a character.
Yeah. So a person is a real someone who either is alive or has been alive.
Yes. Yes.
And you have when you are. I was thinking about that too. That's another thing when about parenting and being in the head. Like we said at the very beginning when we started talking, because the beginning of parenting for mothers is biological mothers is that you are pregnant. So that's a very embodied thing, and it's suddenly you can't move the way you usually do and stuff. And you have. I kept telling myself because I have my 1 year old, my youngest, and I kept looking at my big belly. Slightly over a year ago, and I'm thinking there's a person in here.
Yeah,
so that's also what I mean by person. There was a person in my my belly, and she's now out, and she's a person.
yeah that's so profound,
it is.
Wow.
Yes, so cool, this pregnancy and children and life and thinking about personhood, and life is so much fun to think about and to do, and even though there's so much healing to be done and so much that's gone wrong, it's still great work.
Oh my gosh, there's so much to always take in and marvel at, you know.
Mm.
And it's so easy to forget that because we do get caught up with all the problems and all of the stuff that has to be done, the errands that, need to get done and problems that we have. And it's easy to forget about all of these things that are going right and that are miraculous and beautiful and, that we can marvel at.
Yeah, that can fill us with this sense of joy and gratitude, like for real. I don't mean that in any cliche sense, but like real emotions.
Yes. And even that, for a lot of people, I think many, because we're so disconnected, we have a hard time sometimes feeling those things. And that's why it's so easy to forget them, because again, it goes back to that idea of felt experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if we're disconnected from that, we disconnect from all the difficult things, but we don't get to pick and choose what we, if you disconnect from feeling, you disconnect from feeling.
Mm.
Right? So you're disconnected from all of it. If this is your, kind of the protective parts of your mind that are disconnecting you from it, it just disconnects you from feeling. Period.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can survive. And so, a lot of people are disconnected from that. And I remember, not too long ago, there was this email that got circulated in it. You were supposed to answer a bunch of these questions and then, hit reply to all kind of things so everybody could see the responses. And one of the questions was, when was the last time you cried?
Mm.
And so many of the people who responded said they couldn't remember.
Oh, for me, that's very easy. It's like just 5 minutes ago.
I know.
I don't know. I always only cry because I'm sad. I cry for a lot of reasons. Like I get touched very easily and then I cry.
Me too.
Yeah.
But I was disconnected from that for a long time. It took me a long time to get reconnected with that. Mm-hmm. I think it was just part and parcel of, survival things, being stuck in my head through, the academic,
mm-hmm.
Part of life that I went through. And, I was very disconnected from mm-hmm. all of that. And that made me really sad. you know, to see that people couldn't remember the last time that they cried. This was quite a few years ago. Mm. But yeah, and that's been a big part of mindfulness practice for me. And I know a lot of people who start, you know, getting reconnected with all of these knots and experiences that they've had tucked away, sometimes will have this experience of, you know, when they start to feel again, it feels like their chest is like sort of cracking open.
Yeah.
And all of this kind of light, it feels like this light kind of emerging, and it's very, very powerful and very, very overwhelming. Mm. And that's some, for some people, that's the kind of their first real taste of somatics if they've been disconnected for a long time, you know. And I remember that happening to me when I first started doing mindfulness. And the first time it happened, I was so overwhelmed. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, what is happening? Yeah. And it was almost like this, you know, which I realized I had done my whole life. It was like this opening up of intensity of feeling that I felt. My initial reaction was to gather it all up and shove it back in. Because yeah. that is not safe to let out. I don't know what to do with that. And I'm just going to gather all that up, tuck it back in, and, yeah. you know, close the door.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, taken me a while to be comfortable with, you know, slowly opening that door and allowing that to, you know, slowly open up.
I'm not comfortable with, I cry so easily. And the other, like, I really, really, the other day I met this woman and she was like, how are you? You know, and I said, no, I'm fine. I'm really happy. And I realized I had probably teared up a little bit. And I'm like, but I just tear up very easily because I'm so easily touched.
Yeah.
And she looked at me with this like kind of shock / slightly loving face anyway. And she goes, it means you have an open heart. So mm-hmm. I said, yeah, I absolutely do. I said,
yes.
So I guess it was positive for her, but I mean, I wish I could control it more, but this is kind of when I have this feeling that I wish I could control my tear channels, like a little bit more, it wouldn't be too much to ask, I feel.
Yeah.
But then I'm just like, screw, damn, and fuck the 20th century for making me feel that I have to hide.
Yes. That. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing, you know, that this feeling that we have to lock that up because it doesn't feel safe to let that out. That's, you know, the world we live in.
Yeah.
And that's
or lived
sad.
At least. Let's now we've, I think, I mean, I've had it with that world, so I'm going to change it.
Yeah.
Now. Yeah, the new professional leader type person cries when it's a, when they need to, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Amen.
Yeah. 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 But I know what you mean about the feeling that it would be nice to just be able to manage it a little bit. Because I've had situations, you know, where I've been at a wedding. Yeah. And a certain song will come on and I just yeah. lose it. Oh my gosh, this is so beautiful.
Yeah.
So beautiful. And I'm sobbing and sobbing and people are going like, what is wrong with her? Like, are you okay? Are you okay? It's just so beautiful. And but yeah. it's that uncontrollable sobbing that's like, oh my gosh, this is not the time or place, you know?
Yeah. But since I can't fly, what am I going to do with this yeah. excess energy? It's like I have an internal earthquake, so it just goes yeah. so it has to yeah. come out somewhere.
Yes.
It's like a volcano yeah. in my eyes.
Yeah. Well, and that's where I found mindfulness really helpful, because it expands our capacity. So, you know, I was using that analogy of the hose earlier. Mm. You know, where the water is coming through, and you know, when you're highly sensitive and you have this open heart, there's a lot that can come through. And mindfulness has been like this, it's like an expansion of the hose. Mm. It's like an expansion of the capacity of our mind, right? Yeah. To regulate the flow of all of that energy and information. So when you have a lot going through, the capacity is there to hold it in a better way, in a fuller way.
Yeah. Because it's often not just my own feelings, but like, and like you at the wedding, you know, it's probably all the others.
Yes.
Sense of awe that you're letting out too. So you have to have this super huge pose because you're helping all the other people. Like, you know, they had criers, didn't they, at funerals like 500 years ago in Middle Ages in Europe? I have a vague memory of studying that at school at some point. That
really?
They like hired criers to help release the crying.
Oh my gosh, I'd not heard that.
I'm not sure I made it up or whether it's true, or maybe I made it up, but I'm not really sure. I think I'll have. Yeah, really. Wow. So obviously that was me in a previous life. Or maybe it wasn't. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe that's why I'm doing it now.
Maybe. Yeah.
In like being introduced to somatics can be this chest opening, cracking open feeling.
Yeah, for some people, yeah.
Yeah, for some people, yes. And I was thinking, when I go to school now and I see, when my daughter goes to school and I see how they work with putting words to feelings in a way that we did not at all do when I was young. Man, my life would have been different if I had known what was going on, you know?
Yeah.
If you could say, I am angry, for instance, when you're angry. And then I was thinking about this joy and gratitude that I fully seriously mean that you can feel without any sense of clichéness or everything is beautiful kind of thing, but like you can feel it as I want to say non-sentimental.
You
feel joy and gratitude in a non-sentimental, non-cliché way.
Yeah.
But and I'm sure that the children do that. And you know, if you I imagine 2 4-year-olds and one of them, like a toy breaks or someone takes something from you or something, and with the guidance of the preschool teachers, they can say, they can put words to what happened, and they can, when the one said, when one child maybe says, I'm sorry I took your thing, or I'm sorry it broke, I didn't mean to break it, or whatever, and the kind of gratitude and joy you could feel in that situation, to be able to say, this is gratitude and joy. So that maybe if you are able to, for these new generations who did not grow up in the 20th century, maybe things are really, truly very, very different for them. Mm-hmm. Maybe we have, I have this Reiki lady that I go to. She's in her 70s and she always talks about how the new generations, the people who are born today, and they are so much purer, she always says, and you know, compared to us, my generation, like her, she's 70, we carried so much and we're still carrying it, and you know, many of us didn't, you know, and it makes sense sometimes when I look at you know, the different generations and I see them. Putting words to feelings, probably a really, really good thing. Good idea.
Oh, yes. That helps take a lot of the intensity out of the feelings when you can name it.
Yeah. And maybe even if you haven't felt joy and gratitude in a long time, if you know what they felt like at one point, you can maybe say them to yourself. Yeah. Joy and gratitude. And maybe some of the meaning will come back.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Something like that. So it can work. Yeah. It can also trigger and bring, like magically bring back the feeling if you know what you're calling on, you know, like prayer.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that's a lot of mindfulness practices do that. You know, some of the guided practices will have you you know, call to mind and visualize an experience that you had, that where you were feeling joy, where you were feeling gratitude or some kind of emotion like that. And so you bring it up in your mind and you kind of go into that experience, and then you try to tune into the feeling. You know, what does it feel like to really to be in this experience, to recall this experience? What, you know, what is the felt experience of it? What is the sensation? What sensations do you notice that come up in the body when you recall this experience of joy, when you recall this memory? And that's, you know, one way that you can start to remember what joy feels like in the body.
Yeah, precisely.
What gratitude feels like in the body. And sometimes, you know, depending on where you're at on your healing journey and your path, it can take a while. Sometimes it's just like a very small sensation of something. Sometimes it's nothing. But you know, you keep, when you keep trying to do these things, you know, slowly you begin to, it's like excavating, you know, you just slowly start to access it. And it's like, oh yes, there it is. And once you get the small little glimpse of it, the little light of it, then you can, you know, expand it.
Yeah, you can start. Yeah, you can start watering it and giving it better soil and fertilizer, and put it in the sun, and it'll grow.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay. But I have one more thing that I wrote here, and that's the idea that for to grow, it can be really it can be really useful to do what you don't usually do, like do the opposite of your automatic tendency. So for instance, if your automatic tendency is to be a lot in your head, to go and do Pilates or meditate. But meditation can also be, if you're a person who is a lot like a very action-based person.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
You can meditate anywhere.
Yeah,
exactly. Anytime, doing anything. Yeah. It's not just sitting in lotus on a cushion, you know. You can meditate anywhere.
Yeah, and you don't have to. It doesn't have to take several hours.
No. Yeah, that's one of the things that I teach people is, you know, you can do these little mini meditations, which, you know, are kind of like just little micro hits, and just, you know, 10 seconds of tuning into something that you're experiencing. What is my experience of, you know, I'm washing dishes. What is my experience of this soap and the warm water? And, you know, it, even just 10 seconds, that's a little meditation, tuning into the sensory experience.
What do you do just before a class? Like, do you have a ritual? Or like, how do you do that? Like, what is my experience of sitting here with my computer?
You know what? Sometimes it depends on the day and what I've been doing before. So sometimes I need to do some, you know, if I'm feeling kind of amped up because I've been running around driving my kids or shuttling them off to school or whatever, and I'm feeling a little amped up, like I'll do some somatic based things to try and disperse some of that energy. So I'm not so, I'm not revving so high. Or sometimes, yes, I'll just sit and kind of tune in to myself. And, you know, for me, when I sit, like before a class, or even when I'm sitting in teaching a class, I have this experience of, you know, tuning into myself and tuning into what's going on around me, and it's like this sense of home. And so I try to connect with that sense before a class of, you know, being in the present moment and noticing, you know, what's going on around me, what's going on within me, and, you know, just letting it be there and being in this place that for me feels like home. So that I'm bringing that with me into the space and the people that I'm working with, or even with clients.
Bringing the sense of home. I love that. I think that's the concluding sentence.
Bringing a sense of home. I'm thinking about something my mentor said, about how we can't really see healing as an event that happened just once. Home, time, home and time, home in time. Thank you for listening. Till soon.